Ay bobo. Welcome to the Agua Cerrito podcast show, where we honor the divine, spark personal liberation, and deconstruct Haitian voodoo. I'm your host, Knowledge, also known as Konef Kife. Every episode is a digital offering to the sacred spirits, ancestors, and vibrant culture of Haitian voodoo. Through storytelling, interviews, and reflections, we will explore its roots, its power, and its impact. Voodoo is more than spirituality. It is life, legacy, and liberation. Welcome to the Agua Cerrito podcast. In today's episode, we will discuss the resistance during the transatlantic slave trade and how voodoo played a major role in sparking the Haitian Revolution. Before we get started together, let's ground ourselves. We're going to breathe in together three times. Inhale serenity. Exhale fear. Inhale acceptance. Exhale doubt. Inhale joy. Exhale uncertainty. Allow your breath to align with your heartbeat. We honor the Almighty, the divine spirits, and the ancestors who walk with us, those of the earth, water, fire, and air. We honor the spirits of our mothers, our fathers, and all those who came before us, especially those who endured the transatlantic slave trade, whose resilience and wisdom guides us still. May this space be filled with light, with wisdom, and with truth. May hearts and minds be liberated to receive what is needed. May guidance flow freely. Lessons be learned. And connections be deepened. Aibobo, agoago, bo, asao, alaso, awoshenago, jabodo, afutai, bilolo, swakongo, kwa, sem, bo. Welcome to the Agua Cerrito podcast. In today's episode, we are going to take some time and really discuss the events and activities that took place prior to the Haitian Revolution. So we're going to just give like a summary, because I feel like we could do a whole season just unpacking all the events that took place during that time. But we're going to talk about what happens up until the eve of the Haitian Revolution sparking. Before we get started in this conversation, there's a passage that I found on Anthrocyclopedia that I thought does a really nice job of like summarizing today's conversation. So the passage goes, understanding Vodou means, first of all, focusing on the transformations it underwent as a result of the experiences of Africans originating from many different ethnic groups. This is going to be an important component when we think about Vodou. So I want to just emphasize the transformation that Vodou underwent. Remember, it was Vodoun before it arrived to the Americas. So understanding Vodou is understanding the transformations it underwent as a result of the experiences of enslaved Africans that originated from many different ethnic groups who were eager at a very early stage to establish the conditions for their freedom from slavery. And the passage goes on to say, anthropological research will always be haunted, or at the very least intrigued, by the astonishing effort made by the enslaved Africans who managed to produce a new religious and cultural system which integrated at one and the same time elements handed down from the various ethnic groups now living together in the same area. Those imposed by the institution of slavery, as well as those handed down from the Amerindians, this intercultural mix of very heterogeneous elements seems to encapsulate the unique nature of Vodou. Now, understanding how, you know, one like edit I'm going to say to that passage, because I think it's a great passage that kind of frames today's conversation. Even though it's talking about produce, you know, this is kind of the efforts across many different ethnic groups that were brought to the island and how they came together and really formed this new religious and cultural system. Even though it was kind of considered new in terms of the Americas, I want to emphasize that this was not new in the sense that they were taking their specific identities and religious and spiritual principles from their homeland and then coming together and cross-pollinating them in what became Vodou. So I think it's important when sometimes folks like, oh, you know, Vodou was a new religion. It was actually a mixture of a lot of ancient religions that came together as a means of these people's survival. And in today's episode, we will attempt, I'm going to say we're going to attempt, right? Because the story is so vast, but we are going to attempt to break down key moments during this transformation towards freedom. I have heard different iterations of this story. And in the different iterations that I've heard, I have seen in some of them attempts to just dilute, you know, or sanitize, you know, there's like a lot of sanitized, clean versions of what these ancestors, what these enslaved Africans faced. And in this episode, we are not going to sugarcoat it. Our goal is to just really deep dive. Again, we're talking about deconstructing, right? We want to deep dive into some of the challenges that the enslaved Africans that came to the Americas faced, those specifically on the island of Hispaniola, Saint-Domingue. We're going to take that. And I just want to give a quick warning. This is an episode that may be triggering. It may be triggering for those that are sensitive. So this is one of those episodes that, you know, I just want to kind of put a little bit of a disclaimer warning. You know, we're going to share some not so fun information, but it is necessary to share the truth. It is necessary to share the truth in order to really help people understand what the enslaved Africans that came to the island actually faced, that led them to fight for their freedom to the death. So we're going to share some graphic, but they're going to be truthful details of what many individuals faced during that time. So I'm gonna start the conversation here. We're gonna start. The year was 1492. Before it was called Haiti, this land already had a name. It was actually called Quisqueya, and Quisqueya was one of the original Taíno names for the entire island that became known as Hispaniola. And so when we think about Hispaniola today represents what in modern day we call Haiti, and what we call modern day, what we call the Dominican Republic. Okay. In the Taíno language, the word Quisqueya means mother of all lands or great land. And it had that name because it really emphasized the island's richness, its fertility, and its beauty. The Taínos also had another name. They called it Haiti, and Haiti, not Haiti. It was called Haiti, and Haiti is spelled A-Y-I-T-I, or the land of high mountains. And so for years, if we go back to 1492, And before that time, the land by the original inhabitants was called Quisqueya, or was called Haiti. Okay. In 1492, Christopher Columbus landed on the shores of Quisqueya, and the island forever changed. He claimed the island for Spain. And as a conqueror, he ended up renaming Quisqueya or Haiti. He renamed it Hispaniola. And in his efforts in terms of reclaiming the island for Spain and renaming it Hispaniola, him and his crew unleashed a storm of violence on the Taínos. They forced the Taíno people of the island at that time to mine gold and to labor for their quote-unquote new masters. And so for many, many years, the Taino population was nearly wiped out. They nearly went extinct. For decades, they experienced disease that came from the Spanish conquerors. They were overworked. And just general dehumanizing cruelty that they faced really brought them to the brink of extinction. And so, you know, we cannot talk about Vodou and we cannot talk about the history of Quisqueya, the history of Haiti, the land of the mountains, the mother of all lands. We cannot talk about that without acknowledging the ancestral people, the ancestral Taino people of the land. So I want to acknowledge, to begin this conversation, to acknowledge them. In my family lineage, we always honor the Taino people within our Vodou practices. And so with this spirit, I would like to take a moment to say a few words to remember the brave, the courageous Taino people of Quisqueya. Today, we honor the souls of the Taino, those who once walked freely upon the sacred mountains of Quisqueya, those who fished the rivers and planted the cassava, those who danced beneath the full moon and whispered to the ceiba trees, trees we also know as mapu trees. Great people of Quisqueya, we want to remember you. We want to honor your struggles, though your pain has been hidden. We want to sing your songs, though they tried to silence them, so that you may know, even after centuries, you are not forgotten. Nous songeons, we remember you. Nous respectons, we honor you. Et nous pas jamblier, ou. We will never forget you.
Thank you.
So we're going to fast forward and talk about the next key moment in this story. The year was 1522. So we'll start there. With fewer indigenous people left to exploit, because again, they nearly brought them to the brink of extinction, the Spanish decided to turn to others. They decided that they were going to focus on bringing enslaved Africans and transporting them onto the island of Hispaniola. And so by the early 1500s, Spanish ships began arriving with the enslaved Africans that were stolen from their homelands, that were stolen from the continent of Africa. And I said 1522, I'm actually going to go back. We're going to go back to 1502, where Juan de Cordovo, a merchant from Seville, Spain, ended up sending enslaved Africans to Hispaniola. And around that same time, the Spanish king and queen passed a law that allowed the transport of enslaved Africans to Hispaniola. And then the Spanish crown ended up authorizing the importation of slaves from Africa. Okay. So this was in the early 1500s, where the Spanish king and queen, they pretty much passed a law that says, yes, individuals from Spain can begin lawful transport, and the migration to Hispaniola begins. What was interesting is that there's not enough, in my opinion, there's not enough credit that was given to those, to the groups of the enslaved Africans that were stolen from their homelands and brought to this island in order for them to labor for free. These were not just quote unquote enslaved Africans. They were not nameless, faceless people. These folks had an identity. And before their capture and enslavement, they were forcibly taken from different regions across West and Central Africa. That was where a bulk of the enslaved Africans came from. But before they arrived, before they were captured, many of them belonged to highly organized societies. Many of them belonged to societies that had thriving economies, that had established complex political systems, complex and rich spiritual systems. You know, these were not just quote unquote generic enslaved Africans without a name or a face. Many of the regions where people were taken were from places like the Kingdom of Diomé. So many folks were, they had a royal background. So Kingdom of Diomé is now modern day Benin. You have many people come from the Congo Kingdom, right? When we think about what is Angola or the Democratic Republic of Congo. You think about the Oyo Empire within Nigeria. You think about Gambia, which was a combination of Senegal and Gambia, home of where the Mandinka people came from. The Akan kingdoms from Ghana and, the Ivory Coast. So these were people that came that had their own civilization. And each of the individuals that came, they held various different diverse roles within their society. I'm going to just name a couple of them, because again, there's just not enough, in my opinions, there's not enough centering on really helping reclaim the identity of the enslaved Africans that came to this island during that time. They weren't just enslaved Africans. These people were farmers. They were agriculturalists. Many of them, they were skilled. They knew how to grow rice. They grew yams. They grew other crops, right? And because of those farmers and agriculturalists, they then influenced farming on that island and throughout the Caribbean. You had blacksmiths and metal workers, individuals that were skilled with creating tools and weaponry and ceremonial objects, right? Which are highly respected across many African societies. You had healers and herbalists, people that had deep spiritual and medicinal knowledge of plants and herbs and knew how to use them for healing, for health, and for rituals. We see a lot of this still, emphasized and influenced within Haitian Vodou, influenced in terms of herbal medicine that's used not only in Haiti, but across other Caribbean islands. You had priests and priestesses and diviners, people who were responsible for maintaining balance between the physical and spiritual realms. And these individuals shaped the traditions and shaped the foundations of Vodou. You know, when I read that passage earlier about Vodou being a transformation of combined different ethnic groups, they played a major role in that. Each of these individuals played a major role in that. Warriors and military leaders were some of these enslaved Africans. Some actually came from warrior societies, like the Dayomi Amazons, you know, the female warriors. Or if we think about the Congo military, they brought their resistance strategies to Haiti, which they passed on from generation to generation, which led to helping support the Haitian Revolution. These individuals were merchants and traders. They were skilled in trading and exchanging goods. They were artists and musicians. They were drummers. They were storytellers. They understood how to preserve history and culture. They were fishermen and boat builders. You know, they were skilled at fishing. They were skilled at making boats. They were skilled at maritime navigation. So these weren't just a bunch of just, okay, we're going to just call them blanket enslaved Africans. These individuals were diverse. They were talented. And they were valuable members of their individual societies. So we want to hold space for that. We want to hold space for the talent that was in the skills that were embodied, that were forced into this labor, right? But despite their forced displacement, these skills and traditions and their knowledge systems were not lost. They were actually adapted, and they ended up becoming a fabric of what we know as Haitian culture through the resistance. So it's important to understand how these different individuals that was, again, a talented workforce, while they were forced into slavery, their resistance and their talent kept them alive, right? And they were able to pass it on from generation to generation. Hope you're enjoying today's episode. Have a question, comment, or feedback? Feel free to send us an email at aguacerito@gmail.com. That's aguacerito@gmail.com. You can also visit us on the web at www.aguacerito.com. For more information about past episodes, show notes, and more. So I want to take us now to the 1600s. By the late 1600s, France ended up taking control of the western part of Hispaniola and renamed it Saint-Domingue. And the French, so remember the beginning of the story was, it was Quisqueya, the Spanish came over. By the late 1600s, a new conqueror, France, the French came over. And the French saw one thing with this island. They saw money, they saw dollar signs, they saw profit. Because remember, this was a land, as the Taino people described, a land rich, not only with its richness and its beauty, but very fertile. It was a very fertile island, wealthy island. And when the French came and took over western parts of Hispaniola, they ended up transforming it into one of the most valuable colonies in the entire world at that time. Not only one of the most valuable, the most wealthiest. So Hispaniola or Saint-Domingue or Haiti, whichever name you want to use, became the most valuable and the wealthiest colony in the entire world on the backs of the enslaved African workforce. It ended up at one point during the late 1600s, it ended up producing 40% of the world's sugar, 60% of the world's coffee, and over what in today's market, probably even higher, close to $1 billion in export and of indigo, of cotton, of cocoa. So this was not a small island, very valuable, very profitable. But behind this wealth was severe blood, sweat, and extreme suffering of those that were enslaved. In 1685, the king of France issued what became infamously known as Code Noir, or the Black Code. And the king essentially established through this document that slavery was officially legal, giving plantation owners absolute control over the enslaved Africans. And the purpose of Code Noir was essentially to further exploit, control, and dehumanize the enslaved Africans while justifying slavery through Catholicism. So the goal of Code Noir was really to do a couple of things. It was to focus on complete and totally erasure of the African identity and culture. It was designed to legalize extreme violence against enslaved Africans. And it sought to ensure that the enslaved Africans continued to remain powerless, to reinforce this idea of powerlessness in order for them to continue to leverage the wealth of the island through the labor of the enslaved Africans. And I want to read to you all some of the law. You know what? I'm going to read all of the laws here. All the laws of enslavement that was put into place that really ratcheted up the already extreme conditions. It was already bad, but this really ratcheted up to the next level. So Article 1 of Code Noir: expel all Jews from the colonies. Article 2 orders that all enslaved people must be baptized and instructed in the Roman Catholic faith. Article 3, it forbid the practice of any other religion than Catholicism on the island. Article 4, it prohibited enslaved people from practicing any form of African religious traditions. Okay, these religious and cultural suppressive tactics of Code Noir are really important to understand the birth and the justification of how Vodou became, started to really take shape, right? Because of this suppression, okay? If we go to Article 5, it declares that enslaved Africans are the property of their masters, okay? Article 6, it states that enslaved Africans cannot own property. Anything they acquire belongs to their master. Article 7, it prevents enslaved people from engaging in commerce or trade without their master's permissions. So these three really focused on creating a certain type of legal status that, you know, completely oppressed enslaved Africans at that time. Article 8 prohibits enslaved people from gathering in groups as these were seen as potential threats for rebellion. Article 9 forbids marriage between enslaved people and free individuals without their master's approval. Article 10, and this is sad, states that children born to enslaved mothers are automatically enslaved. Article 11, it forbid enslaved Africans from carrying weapons. Article 12, any enslaved person who strikes their master could be executed. Okay. Article 13 allows masters to chain or whip enslaved people for disobedience, but does not allow them to kill without reason. Article 14. Any runaway enslaved people, which we know today as Maroons, who are absent for more than a month can have their ears cut off. Repeated offenses result in branding or death. Article 15 forbids enslaved people from gathering for dances, ceremonies, or funerals without their master's permission. Article 16 masters may free their enslaved people, but only with official approval. Article 17 free black people are considered French citizens and have the same rights as whites, which is an interesting as a to freedom, even though in practice, obviously, discrimination continued to persist for those that were able to, benefit from these articles. Article 18, masters have the right to sell enslaved people like property. Article 19, enslaved people may not testify in court except against other enslaved people. Do you hear this? Enslaved people may not testify in court unless it's against other enslaved people. Article 20. If an enslaved person is wrongfully accused and executed, the master will receive compensation. Article 21. Enslaved people cannot assemble in public places. Article 24. If an enslaved person is found guilty of plotting rebellion, they will be tortured and executed. And the last article, Article 25. If a master illegally frees an enslaved person, that person can be re-enslaved by another owner. So, as you can see from these 25 articles of Code Noir that was passed by the King of France at that time, to the French, the enslaved African people, they had no past, they had no ancestors, they had no future, they had no skills, they had no talent. They were only to do one thing, and that was to serve a lifetime of servitude. It was to help continue to create and generate wealth from the island. Life was already difficult for the enslaved Africans at that time, but it became much, much worse after the Black Code was enacted. Because it became really clear that people could do, the masters at those times, the colonizers can do whatever they want to these individuals. And the sad part about these articles is that, remember, it was illegal for enslaved Africans to read and write. So a lot of these rules were being enforced on people that A, did not either speak the language or B, could not read and would face torture if they even tried to read it. So they started to experience this extreme harsh conditions and not even understanding why this hardship was happening to them. And while it was widely known that the slave trade in Haiti was not only one of the most wealthy, but it was because it was also one of the most brutal colonies in the world, given the vast wealth it was producing. The average life expectancy for a slave during this time was 21 years. And life was cruel. It was extremely cruel beyond our own human comprehension for the enslaved Africans of Hispaniola. They experienced well over 16 plus hour work days in the blistering heat, cutting, whether it's with sugarcane or producing various different materials. They were working night from dawn till dusk, literally every single day, and being punished immensely during that time. I'm gonna go into what some of the punishments and some of the torture that they experienced. Some of the physical torture and mutilation they experienced were things like whipping or lashings. That was actually one of the most common punishments, where enslaved people were tied to posts and then whipped with leather or metal-tipped whips, and sometimes received 200 or more different lashings, leaving permanent scars across their back, on their legs, across their entire body. So whipping and lashing was one of the common ways that the enslaved were tortured. They were tortured with iron collars and masks. The masks, they were collared with spikes that locked around their neck to prevent them from escaping. And then they wore sometimes iron face masks to stop enslaved people from eating sugarcane or talking too much or talking to their, let's say, neighbor. Amputation was used as a form of torture. If enslaved Africans got caught running away or disobeying orders, as you can see what was talked about in Code Noir, they can have their ears or their feet or their hands cut off as a mean of punishment. Sometimes the punishment was branding. Many enslaved Africans were branded like cattle, pretty much with their, you know, bearing their master's initials. So they were branded on their shoulders, they were branded on their back, some of them on their faces, with their master's initials, just like they were property. Some of them were castrated. Some of the enslaved men were forcibly castrated as a punishment for attempting to escape or for alleging to have sexual relations with white women. Some individuals was even far as to be burned alive. If they were accused of rebellion or poisoning their masters, they were burned alive in public as a way to warn others, if you do the same thing this individual did, you're going to have the same fate. So it was like a way to really control the masses from a psyche perspective. And some of them, in some extreme cases, were skinned alive. Enslaved people, some of them were skinned alive as a punishment for leading revolts. So the more they found individuals that resisted, the harsher the punishment is that those individuals experienced. Other ways that they tortured and mutilated enslaved Africans, they have what's called the kafal. And the kafal is when the enslaved people were chained together in long lines. You may have seen these in different pictures. When you see sometimes pictures of the enslaved Africans during that era, they were chained together in long lines by their necks, their hands, or their feet, and made movement very painful and in a way to also minimize their ability to escape. They also have what's called the carcan. The carcan was a wooden collar that was a heavy wooden yoke placed around their neck and shoulders to prevent the enslaved individuals from moving their arms or lying down. Again, another way to restrain them, to, you know, keep them in control physically. Enslaved people were sometimes locked in wooden stocks for hours or days, left exposed to the sun and insects, right? Just overall public humiliation. And then there was also underground prisons or slave dungeons. You hear about slave dungeons in different parts of not only the Caribbean, but also in other parts of the Americas, where they were thrown into these small airless pockets of kind of these underground cells for weeks without food and water as a way, again, to help create and force and oppress individuals to not resist or rebel. And then when it came to other types of punishment, people were hung. They were hung in trees. You know, we've seen a lot of those types of pictures from that era. Some people were tied to a wheel and their bones were systematically broken with iron bars before being left to die. That process was called breaking on the wheel. They were drowned. There were some masters that would tie heavy stones to enslave folks and throw them into the ocean as a means of punishment. And then there's what's called quartering or dismemberment. And this is when, if there's enslaved individuals that were accused of poisoning their master or revolting, they were tied to four horses and pulled apart limb by limb. And a lot of these extreme punishments were done in public. Other ways that they were forced into submission, quote unquote, I say quote unquote because the Haitian Revolution happened, but other ways that they kind of really played on the psyche to help seek to erase African identity, to really have people focus on their role as in servitude, there was deliberate separation of ethnic groups to break down any cultural bonding, anything they have in common, and to prevent rebellion. So a lot of individuals were paired with people they didn't speak the same language as those individuals. They may have looked alike, they may have looked similar, but they were from very different ethnic groups, and that was by design. What was interesting is that during that time, some church missionaries claimed that slavery was a gift. It was a way to make savages into true human beings. And that was some of the language they essentially justified slavery as a means of following God. And they pointed to the curse of Ham. And it really painted that Africans were essentially cursed and they were doomed to servitude. Now, everything I just described of what people experienced, I don't think the history books really unpack the degree of cruelty that the enslaved Africans endured, nor did they account for the many years that this practice took place before the Haitian Revolution officially broke out in 1791. So, from the 1500s, this started at mass and then accelerated. It started at mass in 1500s. It accelerated into the 1600s. So from the 1500s to 1791, before the revolution started, it's not when it ended, right? Because it was over a decade, it was decade or so plus revolution. That represents over 290. I'm going to repeat that again. 290 years. 290 years that enslaved Africans experienced hardship. They experienced extreme cruelty. They experienced extreme dehumanization, de-identification. And what the ancestors of many Haitian descendants experienced is far beyond our modern day comprehension. You always hear, oh yeah, there was slavery and then there was a revolution. No, this was 200 years of this behavior, of the drownings, of the dismemberment, of the ethnic separation, of the hanging. 290 years of chains and shackles, of the underground prisons, of the branding, of being castrated, of being skinned alive, of being amputated, of going through whippings, 290 years of working from dawn till dusk for days on end without any retribution. For any individual to have survived this level of atrocity was indeed a miracle in and of itself. So if you are listening to this episode and you are of Haitian descent, I want to take a moment to honor and remember all of our ancestors, both known and unknown, who lived during this era. Some survived this era and some did not. I want to take a moment. I want to say the dates just to give reverence to the ancestors that lived this ordeal, whether they survived or they didn't. And I'm going to say the dates. I'm going to actually say them by decades. So even that is not enough. I don't think it justifies it. I feel like I can do a whole episode just saying dates, just to acknowledge the hundreds and thousands of individuals. Remember that the average life expectancy was 21 years. This happened. This continued to 1510. This conditioning continued to 1520. This continued to 1530. This continued to 1540. This violence continued through 1550. This violence continued through 1516. This violence continued through 1570. This violence continued through 1518. This violence continued through 1590. This violence continued through 1600. This violence continued through 1610. This violence continued through 1620. This violence continued to 1630. This violence continued to 1640. This violence continued to 1650. The violence continued to 1660. The violence continued to 1670. This violence continued to 1680. This violence continued to 1690. This violence continued to 1700. This violence continued to 1720. This violence continued to 1730. The violence continued in 1740. The violence continued in 1750. The violence continued in 1760. The violence continued in 1770. The violence continued in 1780. The violence continued in 1790. Despite all of the hardships that happened for almost 300 years, that's multiple hundreds of generations of enslaved Africans. No whip, no law, and no lie could erase the memory of freedom from the minds of those that were enslaved. I wanted to take this moment and give space and honor and remember all of our ancestors, both known and unknown, both those that survived, those that didn't survive, during this close to 300 year period of harsh cruelty and dehumanization. I want to switch gears and begin to talk about some of the seeds of resistance that during that 200 plus, close to 300 year period began to take shape that allowed the enslaved Africans, despite all the harshness that they were experiencing, allowed them to find ways to preserve their identities. There's a couple of different things that started to happen that over time picked up speed, that essentially were the building blocks of the Haitian Revolution. I'm going to start with talking about slave funerals, because when we think about slave funerals, as they were called at that time, within African cosmology, and we talked about this in a past episode, African cosmology is steeped in ancestor veneration. So when there were opportunities to have a funeral, those were considered sacred gatherings. There were moments when enslaved could honor their dead, but at the same time secretly plan rebellion. And so these enslaved funeral sessions began to take shape, and they all, again, even if they came from different ethnic groups across West and Central Africa, their belief was strong. They believed, again, according to their cosmology, that death would return them to Africa, to their ancestors. And some of them believe that if they even take their own lives, if they commit suicide, that would be the only way home. Hence this idea of Guinea, right? Guinea is the mythical heaven, or in others, considered a return to Africa. So at the time, the return to Africa represented Guinea. It represented heaven, given the harsh conditions that they were facing at that particular time. The funerals played a dual role, as I mentioned. They were not only a way to honor the dead and honor their ancestors, they also were a place where they can gather and secretly plan rebellion. So there were a few times when enslaved African people could legally gather without suspicion. These events, they brought together large groups of folks, helped them bond, helped them really kind of center and rebuild where they can in pockets. They can rebuild their collective identity. Even if they came from different ethnic groups, they use those moments as opportunities of community. And those opportunities of community helped strengthen their bonds with each other, help them get to know each other more. And that was critical for organizing rebellions. And in some cases, depending on the part of the island, voodoo ceremonies accompanied the funerals, where spirits of ancestors were honored, where they could do those. And because funerals were one of the few legally permitted gatherings at that time on the colony, they became secret meeting places for resistance, and revolutionary messages could be passed under the guise of mourning. So they kind of played a dual role. So funerals and people looking forward to attending funerals as a means to helping organize rebellions. You would sometimes have individuals would gather in the forest at night for voodoo ceremonies, which was a fusion of African spiritual traditions and elements of Catholicism. So because if on the surface level, they would be using the Catholic saints that were depicted in churches, and those became the masks for their African laws, which allowed them to practice their true faith in secret. And that is where we saw early signs of syncretism of voodoo, and voodoo again, and Haitian voodoo is a blend of multiple different ethnic group practices masked with Roman Catholicism. That was the beginning of that taking shape. In addition to funerals and early voodoo ceremonies that they started to have around that time, they also had what was called calendas. And calendas, pretty much on Sundays, the enslaved Africans on the island were allowed, you know, to have a kind of have a little bit of a time off, not a full day off, right? But they had a little bit of a respite. So on Sundays, these were gatherings where they got together and they danced and they had drumming and music. And because they allocated these gatherings typically happened on a Sunday evening, they organized those as calendas. So in addition to having pockets of time for funerals, the calendas also helped, was an important building block towards the Haitian Revolution. The calendas, they provided a way for Africa, for the enslaved people to maintain their heritage and also help people to share. There was a lot of knowledge sharing, a lot of identity, cultural sharing, where people were sharing, well, this is what in my country, what we eat, or this is in my country, this is how we do this dance, or in my country, this is what we call that language. There's a lot of information sharing of each other at that time. Again, because it was one of the few times that the enslaved could congregate, they always use these as a double. So yes, they got together and on the outside looking in, it looked like they were just having a great time, but they also was organizing, they were spreading ideas, they were coordinating rebellions, and many calendas were tied to voodoo ceremonies because it helped reinforce the sense of resilience and community. And so those were more than celebrations. When we think about these calendas, there were ways to keep their culture, their heritage alive. There were ways to pass on secret messages through song and movement. And for those that had individuals that came from their country with military experience, those also became pockets and opportunities to train for battle, to train and how to coordinate, how to, you know, have rhythm, be able to know how to fight in battle. So they were more than just quote unquote parties, Sunday night parties. They were Sunday night organizing opportunities. And between the funerals and the voodoo ceremonies that happened at night and the calendas, they became the political, the cultural, and the revolutionary tools that essentially laid the groundwork for the Haitian Revolution to take place. Another kind of building block, and a very important building block, was what was called Maronage, right? Or the Maroon. So some enslaved people, they didn't want to sit around and wait for freedom. They didn't want to work these harsh conditions. So they ran. They literally left. you know, they ran to into mountains and they went in hiding. They went in hiding into the forest, into the swamps. And any individuals that ran off and ran away from their slave, from the slave masters or from the colonies, they automatically became known as Maroons. And the Maroons built their own communities. They pretty much built their communities. They survived off the land and they really got good at organizing, right? So the what was called Maronage refers to the act of enslaved Africans escaping and forming their own interdependent communities. These were also called Maroon societies. And because these were like runaway slaves, the Maronage, in addition to the kalindas, the funerals, and the Vodou ceremonies, became critically important because they defied the plantation system. They showed that actually enslaved people could live independently, right? They had a good command of knowledge of the land and the terrain. They learned about the herbs and the plants. You know, they were already people that was, you know, in touch with nature. So when some enslaved Africans saw like, hey, these Maroons are able to like live, you know, in the forests and the mountains and in remote areas, and they can resist oppression, that inspired others. That inspired folks to seek freedom. And many Maroons, they developed survival skills. They learned guerrilla tactics, right? They learned ways to organize because, again, they were not working day in and day out. So there was a lot of military training that took place within the Maroon societies. And they essentially became safe spaces. The Maroon communities, they provided shelter. They helped people like train. They helped people organize different types of revolts. And they also were partners and allies as rebel forces within the Haitian Revolution. Because again, these Maroon societies, they had a good command of the terrain. They knew the forest. They knew the various different types of shelters. They knew like all of the, you know, kind of all the different lands, the swamps, the mountain. They knew these areas like the back of their hand. And so they became vital. They had vital intel to the Haitian Revolution. And what was interesting is that the Maronage, it was constantly challenging the authority of the French, because it continued, people continued to find ways to try to run away, to join these Maroon societies, and was forcing the colonizers to find, you know, to divert resources to capture runaways. So because it was forcing them to divert their resources, they didn't have as many people watching, you know, the colonies or the crops. And so that in turn allowed some of the slaves be able to organize even further. So the Maronage really became like the glitch in the matrix, so to speak. They were not only able to live and train and organize independently, they were also in contact with enslaved people across different plantations, sharing with them strategies, sharing messages, really being able to unify different groups against the French. And so the legacy of the Maroons, and many Maroon leaders became key figures in the struggle for independence in the Haitian Revolution. Because of their, because of these Maroon communities, they shaped multiple different rebellions. Because remember, the one that was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back is the one that we all know, August 14th, 1791. But that was not the first rebellion. There was multiple rebellions that had happened beforehand. And the Maroons continued to shape the rebellions. Even if they were not successful, they shaped and started to create momentum, right? They started to help create an organized resistance movement. And the colonizers, the masters on the various different plantations, they were afraid, they were deathly afraid of these Maroon societies, and they imposed a lot of punishments for anyone that they found that was practicing or seeking to join these types of groups. And even though they had these severe punishments, many of the enslaved Africans continued to be attracted to the Maroon societies. The punishments were not punishments were not enough. People were willing to die than to continue to live in the harsh conditions that they experienced. One of the great Maroon leaders that I want to talk about today is François Macandal. So Macandal was a Vodou priest and a warrior who led a six-year rebellion through poisonings, armed attack, and pretty much military, like guerrilla warfare, right? So he spent 6 years going from plantation to plantation, colony after colony, leading various different rebellions. And though, even though he was executed, he was captured and executed, let's say in 1758, he left a powerful message. He really put the bug in folks' ear to say, slavery could be defeated. And if we continue these rebellions, you all will obtain freedom. What's interesting is that while this was happening, so remember, the plantation masters was already fearing Maronage. So they were diverting resources to capture people that were going into these mountains, that was kind of doing these organized resistance. So there was a crack in the system where that crack continued to open up more and more and more on the island. But across the ocean in France, another revolution was already taking shape, the French Revolution, right? So in France, at that same time, the people rose up against the monarchy and they overthrew the king and declared liberty, equality, fraternity. And when the enslaved Africans on the island heard that, they said, well, if the French deserve liberty, why don't we? The French colonists refused to extend the rights that they had given to those in France, to the enslaved people. But those enslaved had already made up their minds. If the people can rise against the monarchy in France, so could we. And between all the various different elements of organization, between the funerals, the calendas, the Vodou ceremonies, the Maroon societies, Macandal and his fierce leadership for the last, past 6 years, that was the beginning of the end of slavery on the island of Hispaniola. So I want to take us to close out. I want to take us to August 14th, 1791. In the forest of what's called Mont Rouge, which means Red Mountain, hundreds of enslaved people gathered for a strategic meeting at what is called Bois Caïma, right? And this strategic meeting really was a congregation. It was essentially a working, think of it like a round table at that time, right? But it was a congregation, a congress, if you will, on ways to seek liberation. And at the end of the meeting, they decided to end it with a Vodou ceremony. During that Bois Caïma meeting and during the Vodou ceremony, you had another fierce leader called Boukman Dadi. So Boukman was a Vodou priest as well. He was a Maroon leader. And he said a prayer that, I'm going to read the prayer here, but the prayer he said was really the call for liberation. He said, "The God who created the earth, who created the sun that gives us light, the God who holds up the ocean, who makes the thunder roar, our God who has ears to hear, you who are hidden in the clouds, who watch us from where you are, You see all that the white has made us suffer. The white man's God asks him to commit crimes. But the God within us wants to do good. Our God, who is so good, so just, he orders us to revenge our wrongs. It's he who will direct our arms and bring us the victory. It's he who will assist us. We all shall throw away the image of the white man's God who is so pitiless. Listen to the voice for liberty that speaks in all of our hearts. That was Buchmann's prayer as we know of it today. And we know during that meeting, on August 14th, 1791, multiple ethnic groups that came together and formed and shaped the strategic plans for the revolution also formed and shaped and discussed and brought their spiritual practices to the ceremony that ended that meeting. Another key figure we know during that meeting, Mambo Cecile Fatima, she was a Vodou priestess. She sacrificed a black pig as an offering to the spirits, as so we know the story to be. She sacrificed a black pig as an offering to the spirits, to the ancestors, that the revolution was about to begin. And together, every single individual that gathered for that strategic meeting, they made a sacred pact. They would fight and they would win. They said if they know that they fight and they stick together, they would win. One week later, the revolution begins. The enslaved rose up in fire and fury. Plantations burned. Chains were broken. Masters were poisoned. Masters were killed. The people who had been told they were not human, these individuals who had been beaten and bought and sold. And that is how the Haitian Revolution begun. This wraps up today's episode on the Agua Cerito podcast. And so tune in to our next episode. We have the honor for our first guest, Mambo Charlene, who will join us in our next episode and share with us her experience, her perspective on Bwakaima. It's a very special episode. I'm so looking forward to it. She's going to be our first guest, our first scholar on the Agua Cerito show. And so let's go ahead and close out with prayer as we normally do. Thank you to the Almighty Creator, source of all life and breath. Thank you to the ancestral spirits in the east, west, north, and south. May your presence continue to guide us as we move forward. Thank you to all the spirits of the earth, water, fire, and air, both known and unknown, who sustain and balance us in every moment. Thank you to the ancestors of our mothers, our fathers, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents, whose wisdom and sacrifices have paved the way for our existence. Thank you to all of our ancestors, near and far, for encircling us with your love, your strength, and your internal guidance. We release ourselves into the world with your blessings, asking for your continued protection and guidance as we walk our path. May the light of wisdom, the power of courage, and the bond of love remain with us as we all part ways. May our hearts remain open, our minds remain clear, and our spirits remain strong to continue learning, growing, and thriving together. We affirm that all that is needed has been received. All that is to be learned will unfold, and all that is to be shared will bear fruit in time. Aibobo, Agoago, Bo, Asao, Alaso, Awoshenago, Jabodo, Afutai, Bilolo, Swakongo, Kwa, Sembo. Thank you for tuning into the Agua Cerrito podcast.
Bele, Ambre o Basilo, Pawenu Nancheno. Rele, rele o Basilo, Pawenu Nancheno. Rele, rele o Basilo, Pawenu Nancheno. Rele, rele o Basilo, Pawenu Nancheno. Rele, dambala wedo, kisa na fe. Na rele, dambala wedo, kisa na fe. Toa pu toa, nou lalem toa. Dans ma lave d'eau, relé, en mouré au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Dans ma lave d'eau, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Wa relé ma race à Guinée, qui s'en a fait. Na relé de sous ma race, qui s'en a fait, toi pour toi, nous n'enchaînons. De sou massa, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. De sou massa, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Wa relé dans bala wedo, qui s'en a fait. Wa relé dans bala wedo, qui s'en a fait, toi pour toi, nous n'en la quoi. De sous ma sa, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Dans ma lavado, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Wa relé ma sa Guinée, qui s'en a fait. Wa relé de sous ma sa, qui sa pour nous faire, toi pour toi, nous l'enlève toi. Ogouba David, relé, en mouré au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Dans ma lave d'eau, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Wa relé de sous ma race, qui s'en a fait. Wa relé ma race à Guinée, qui s'en a pour nous faire, toi pour toi, nous n'en la quoi. Dans ma lave d'eau, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Dans ma lave d'eau, relé, relé au basilo, pawe nous n'enchaîno. Na relé ma race à Guinée, qui sa voun fè o. Na relé de sous ma race, qui sa voun fè o. Toi pour toi, nous n'en l'ento. Avec une barrière.
Thank you for joining us on the Agua Cerrito podcast show. Together we honor our ancestors, embrace the beauty of Vodou, and step boldly toward liberation. If this episode resonated with you, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. It helps us amplify the spirit of Haitian Vodou even further. Join us next week as we continue this journey to connect, inspire, and uplift. Until then, walk boldly with your spirits, and remember, the Agua Cerrito Show is not just a podcast. It is a vibration, a celebration, a path to freedom.